Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard as well around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, the release of Utah Josh Holt and his wife from a Venezuelan prison after nearly 2 years, the citizen initiatives that made it to the ballot and those that didn't, the Facebook data center going up in Eagle Mountain, and the debates that took place this week in a couple of Utah political races. In studio for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry. Welcome back, Dan.
Good morning.
Also with us, news columnist Robert Gerke. Hi, Robert. Thanks for making time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And on the phone, we've got Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. And good morning to you, Tommy.
Hey, good morning.
And as always, we'd like to hear your thoughts on the topics we're covering today. Post your questions and comments at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com or call us up. We are at 801-355-8255. Thomas Burr, the country and Utah in particular welcomed Josh home last weekend. Josh Holt, that is, home last weekend. This is the Utah who, along with his wife, was being held in prison in Venezuela. Before we get to the happy ending here, for those who haven't heard this tale yet, where does it start? Why was Josh Holt in Venezuela, and how did he and his wife end up in prison there?
You know, it's a strange and sad story to start with. So Josh Holt's a former Mormon missionary. He went to Washington State and learned to speak Spanish on his mission. And he came home, and he wanted to find a wife who could, you know, help him with his Spanish, who he could speak Spanish with. And he met his wife, Tammy, online. He flew to Venezuela, married her, and they were in her family's condo in Venezuela. It's a government-owned housing, as most things in Venezuela are government-owned. And the police raided it and found an assault rifle and a bunch of grenades. They were charged with espionage, these crimes. The U.S. officials say that they were planted guns. There is nothing that they were actually doing. This was all about a bargaining chip in some form. But he and Tammy spent nearly 2 years in prison.
And they, again, as you said, they said that these charges were fabricated, that the weapons were planted. This was a long process, but how did Holt and his wife get released? What happened to make that happen?
Yeah, so there was a lot that went into this. One, it was some public pressure from U.S. officials, including Senator Orrin Hatch, Representative Mia Love, was very involved in this, keeping the pressure on, keeping not letting anyone forget that Josh and Tammy were being held in prison with U.S. officials say unjustly on trumped-up charges that had nothing to do with what they actually did. So there was a lot of back and forth between the Venezuelan government and the United States. Let's just say that we're not exactly friends right now with the Venezuelans. It's run by essentially a dictatorship. President Maduro just won re-election by like 150% or something like that. People were the U.S. does not recognize the election, neither do a lot of Latin American countries. But in the background, Senator Orrin Hatch reached out to his friend Bob Corker, who's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He had a staffer who had some back channels to the Venezuelan government, who had known Maduro, and one of his top aides, who was referred to as Dracula, which is, you know, I hope I'm never referred to as that. But the guy named is Rafael Lacava, who really was able to secure the release after the Maduro's quote-unquote re-election by saying essentially this will be a gesture you need to the United States. No conditions, as we know of, were lifted. No sanctions were lifted, but it was meant to be a gesture of good faith that maybe the United States will be more favorable if you get rid of the release the guy, the U.S. prisoner, and then let him come back to the United States.
That's, and again, you mentioned that political backdrop, Venezuela in this economic crisis, and the government of Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. government has sanctions on Venezuela, but you're saying that essentially that wasn't part of the negotiations here. This was just a good faith effort.
Yeah, that's gesture. The thought that we know of at the moment. I mean, people are literally starving in Venezuela. There are there's so much sanctions on the government. The government is, as U.S. officials say, is incredibly corrupt. It's a police state. And at the moment, we don't know that there were anything lifted or, you know, on oil or anything like that. But it sounds like, from what I'm hearing, is this is a good faith effort to say, please help us. We're not that bad of people.
Okay, so last weekend, I think it's last weekend, Senator Bob Corker, as you said, Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman, he flies to Venezuela, he picks up Josh and Tammy, and then they fly back to Washington. Is that correct? They meet with the president the same day that they're released?
Yeah, this is kind of nuts. But so a week ago, McCorker flies to Venezuela. He meets with President Maduro. They secure the release of Josh. They put Josh and Tammy and Corker and their jailer, I'm not kidding about this, they literally, the guy who had kept Josh in prison was on the plane. It was a Venezuelan government plane, and they flew here to Washington. And this poor guy who's been stuck in prison for nearly 2 years is then thrust into the media spotlight, sitting in the Oval Office next to President Trump, who was not president at the time he was jailed.
I want to just bring Dan Harry, government and politics editor, in on this conversation. This is a story that we've been following for a while, you know, on and off over the past couple of years. This outcome, the release, do you see it? Is it something that's surprising? It's not a common sort of outcome for people who are being held as conceivably as chess pieces, I guess.
Yeah, I find the whole thing surprising. It seems like we only know part of the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like there are missing pieces that no one has talked about.
Right.
So I don't know what those are, but it would be wonderful to find out.
Right, what the answer. After 2 years in Venezuelan prison, and it was actually a pretty notoriously tough prison, as I understand, Tommy. How is Josh Holt coping? How is his wife coping as well?
You know, so I would echo what Dan said, too. I really think we don't know the full story here, and
okay.
I'm looking forward to finding it out, because it's all so strange in so many ways. But to answer your question, you know, they needed some medical care. Being stuck in a Venezuelan prison was not a good thing for them. Both of them suffered injuries while imprisoned. And they landed at Dulles Airport outside of D.C. It's about an hour outside D.C. They have, I believe they're Navy, you know, doctors in the car with them, checking them out as they're being, you know, whisked away to the White House. And then they spend a day at the Walter Reed Hospital because, you know, they really needed some care. I assume they're going to need some time.
Mm-hmm.
I have just to diatribe for a second, but I have a good friend, Jason Rezaian, who's the Washington Post reporter who was held in Tehran, in Iran for about 18 months in prison. And, you know, the ability for somebody to go from, you know, imprisonment to media spotlight is somewhat dangerous. And, you know, he needed some time to adjust. I assume the Holts are going to need some, you know, some time to just understand their surroundings to start with, let alone deal with, you know, the media inquiries, all the family that wants to see them. They're going to need some time.
Are they returning to Utah? Are they here in Utah?
They're back in Utah, as far as I understand. You know, if I were them, I'd be, you know, locked down in, you know,
right,
house and not taking visitors. But as far as I know, they're back in Utah, hopefully getting some medical care.
And we'll wrap up the story, but you said that Josh Holt said something along the lines of this wasn't the best honeymoon to get his marriage started off with, which was a pretty great attitude for someone who's just been released after 2 years.
You know, I have to say, I was in the Oval Office last Saturday with him, and I have to say, I don't think I'd be as funny as he was. But, yeah, he noted that his marriage started out a bit rocky. You know, being imprisoned a few days after you get married is probably not the best way to start out a marriage. But he seems to be holding his own, and it's going to take some time.
Okay. Well, we've got other stories to tackle from this past week's news that we should turn to, but thanks for this, Tommy. I'm going to remind our listeners that you can join this conversation with your questions and comments by calling us at 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, I want to turn to, from this story of a Utah homecoming to the story of a new arrival in the state of Utah. How's that for a transition? Facebook is building a data center in Utah County in Eagle Mountain. Why is the tech giant building there?
Well, for one thing, they got quite a bit of tax incentives. If you add it up, I think it's about $150 million in tax incentives over a 20-year period. And they also had flirted long and hard with Utah previously in right. West Jordan. And that was a deal, I think, that came close to fruition and then fell through. They actually got a much better offer in New Mexico, and they ended up, they're building a data center there.
This is a little bit of deja vu, though, for Utah, courting Facebook to try and get them to come here. And this was done secretly.
Yep. A lot of these deals are, you know, and we can question that, but that's the practice of GOED and the state economic development folks and local economic development folks. They say, you know, they need to the privacy to negotiate these deals to avoid jeopardizing them as they go. It sort of doesn't feel like that is very transparent to the public, who ends up paying for these tax incentives. And as the government says, the public will get back in spades what they put out because of the tax and payroll that will come here that hadn't been here before.
What is it that Utah and Utah County in particular are getting in Eagle Mountain? I guess it's, as you said, well, they're putting Facebook's reaping this benefit in the form of a tax mm-hmm. cut. What does the county get? What does the state get?
Well, they get a really giant building, or I think four buildings, with these data centers, and they don't get very many jobs. I mean, they'll get a lot of jobs during construction, right? And that'll last a year or so. But after that, we're talking, 30 to 50 jobs somewhere in that neighborhood.
Have there been, you know, again, as we said, this was kept secret until Wednesday when it was unveiled. And you said that was to prevent it from being thwarted in some way. But was that also to prevent public opposition, I guess? And have there been objections that we were able to see, I guess?
Well, here and there you hear things. There was a, BYU a business professor wrote an op-ed in the Provo paper that talked about how, you know, he views it as selling away his children's future. He has children there in the Alpine School District, and that they're giving up some of their tax money as part of this for the increments. But you haven't heard very much opposition to it. There is this question of, is this really worth it when we're talking about basically a couple of handfuls of jobs? The supporters of it say that there is a boomerang effect, that you have a company like Facebook here, and that you can use that to leverage other companies that want to be around Facebook and want to be associated with it. So, you know, we'll see if that's true down the road.
To essentially draw more data centers, however you say it, to Utah.
And, you know, tech-related companies.
Mm-hmm.
I think Gerke wrote a pretty good story that compared this project with the one in West Jordan, and that there are significant differences in it.
Robert, let's bring you in on this. Courting Facebook, you know, courting Amazon, really big companies, is that just what states do now, and is it worth it?
Well, there is this competition among the states. We saw it when Utah was competing with New Mexico for the West Jordan Center that New Mexico ended up getting. But it's just this competition, this fierce competition about who can give away more tax money and lure these businesses in. And as Dan mentioned, we're not talking about a significant number of jobs. It's pretty minor. I mean, 30 employees is not what you would consider a large company by any stretch of the imagination. The upside for again, as Dan mentioned, is the construction. There's going to be a large investment in construction, a potential for expansion through a number of phases. These data centers, they guzzle water because they have to keep these. They're basically just warehouses full of these servers that they have to store their data on. But you got to keep them cool, which means a refrigeration system, which means, they're piping water through there all the time. So we'll see if this works out. It's one of those things. We saw opposition to the West Jordan one because it got leaked before it was finalized that they were going to be doing this, and then the public was able to weigh in opposition to it, including the state school board that didn't want to give away its taxes. So, you know, this one didn't get leaked. This, the deal's done now, I guess, and so we'll see how it serves this county, serves the state.
You know, I remember the water usage thing, the water bill for the NSA data center that's not far away from where this is supposed
about
to go.
13, 14 miles.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was a point of contention when that data center was being built. Is that something that we've heard discussed yet in relation to this data center, Dan?
I haven't heard a lot of questions raised about it, but it certainly seems to be an issue that you're talking about the huge amounts of water that would go there. One other distinction that Robert made in his column was that, you know, West Jordan does have some developable land, but it is, you know, in a lot of ways built out. It's kind of a bedroom community that's trying to get more business in, but it does seem sort of an odd place for a data center with all of that, you know, empty space and those huge buildings taking up a lot of property. Eagle Mountains, you know, it's got a lot of empty property around it, miles and miles, so it's not quite the same situation.
I know that there were some infrastructure benefits, as opposed to jobs, which you guys are pointing to this kind of smaller number of jobs, there were, there's the tax benefits that the state and local leaders are probably excited about, but also some infrastructure spending that Facebook is supposed to be doing in the area.
I mean, they've got to build access to the site, so they're going to have to put in the roads, they're going to have to put in the utilities to, you know, make this thing work. So that's one of the things that the community gets out of this. One of the things that I'm kind of interested to see is how this affects construction costs in the valley and property values. Because right now, you know, we've got this airport project, this $3 billion airport project going on. We're doing, you know, they're getting into some road projects. We're seeing a scarcity of construction workers, a scarcity of supplies, and costs are going up. And that actually has a ripple effect through other parts of the economy. So
you're going to have the new prison construction that starts before long.
Yeah, you've got these big projects that are all ramping up, and construction costs are going to go through the roof.
We'll see what effect that
has. In part because of this, yeah.
Guys, we've still got more news to cover, and unfortunately we have to head to our first break of the show. But when we come back, we will turn to the fate of some citizen ballot initiatives, a recap of some political debates, and the controversial nomination of a Utahn to run America's refugee program. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry, Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, and columnist Robert Gerke. This program is a Friday morning local news roundup, and as always, you are invited to join us with your questions and comments. You can post them at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. Dan Harry, the tallies are in. We now know which initiatives qualified officially for the November ballot. Maybe before we get to anything else, can you just give us a quick tally of those that made it and those that did not make it?
Okay, the Lieutenant Governor's office tells us that the legalization of medical marijuana will be on the ballot, that the Better Boundaries Initiative will be on the ballot, which is creating an independent redistricting commission to recommend political boundaries when we do this in a couple of years, and expansion of Medicaid, which is a proposed tax increase, an expansion that would cover like 150,000 more low-income Utahns, about double the number of the people covered under the legislation passed this year up on Capitol Hill.
That'll be on the ballot. And did you mention the Count My Vote initiative?
Count My
well?
Vote will not be on the ballot, okay. According to the tallies that they have so far. Mm-hmm. But there are lawsuits threatened in that case. The Count My Vote people think that they had sufficient signatures and that there were mistakes or maybe even shenanigans at the county clerk level in some of these districts, and that signatures that were valid voter signatures should not have been disqualified and were. So we may see a lawsuit on that. They've sort of indicated that that's going to happen soon.
This might be a question for Robert Gerke, but is that a plausible route for them, given the way that this initiative law is presented, or the way that it exists now? Can they challenge in court?
Sure.
You can challenge anything.
Absolutely.
In court, yeah.
Yeah. And the other one is the medical and marijuana legalization opponents have already filed suit and say, because there are federal laws prohibiting this marijuana possession, distribution, and sale, that the state can't legalize it like this. So
it's interesting. These two, medical marijuana and the Count My Vote initiative, were fought over tooth and nail. Mm-hmm. You had the signature gathering effort, and then you had the take your signature off of that thing that you signed effort to try and undo. Why were these two so? I guess they're sort of controversial topics.
They're controversial topics, and they also are issues that are hugely popular, but have some powerful opposition bases. So, in the Count My Vote case, you know, hugely popular to allow candidates to access the ballot by getting signatures, but there is a hardcore Republican base that doesn't want that to happen. So they've fought tooth and nail. And in the case of marijuana, you have a whole bunch of interests that are coming out and fighting this. One of them, the LDS Church, has come out in opposition. Political leaders have come out in opposition. The Utah Medical Association has come out in opposition. And as we're seeing more and more now, law enforcement, while not officially opposed, is doing things to try to oppose it.
Hmm. I want to stick with the Count My Vote thing for just a moment. This is already election law. You have a signature route to the ballot as it is now. This initiative is just to, solidify that route?
I think to solidify it, what we've seen is if you have law that is passed by the voters at a general election, it is very hard for legislators then to come back later and tamper with it. It's just kind of a taboo not to do that. We saw that in the case of the school vouchers. School vouchers passed the legislature, but then were thrown out by voters in the general election. And despite many powerful interests wanting to restore vouchers, there hasn't really been a significant effort to do that.
I'm going to turn to Robert Gerke here for a second. It looks likely that the Count My Vote sort of ratification of the SB 54 law isn't going to appear on the November ballot. I mean, depending upon what happens with these court challenges, does that matter? I mean, is the legislature going to try and tamper with that law, do you think, Robert?
You know, there have been attempts over the last few years to try to undermine it, particularly from members of the House. I'm kind of curious to see what happens, because there are a couple of those members who were leaders in that opposition movement are leaving the House. The Senate has sort of held the line, saying we made a deal with SB 54. We're not going to change it. I think the governor has said that he would oppose any efforts to repeal SB 54. So it appears that this signature path to the ballot is safe for now. And I'm not entirely convinced that at the end of the day the initiative doesn't get on the ballot. I'm not sure that it matters as much as, you know, it's not a do or die deal. So I think SB 54 is now, we've gone through a couple election cycles. We've seen the products of it. We've seen John Curtis beat the convention nominated Chris Herod, and so, you know, and we've seen a couple of these couple elections like that where we've ended up with probably more reasonable, more mainstream candidates than we would get through the convention. So I think there is support for maintaining that in place. The biggest thing that frankly, the initiative does is it changes the thresholds of the number of signatures that candidates need to get.
Because
right now, it lowers that, makes it a little bit easier, and probably makes it so you would see more people going that route.
Meanwhile, as Dan Harry pointed out, the medical marijuana initiative is seeing more and more opposition. It appears likely to show up on the ballot, again, depending upon whether or not a challenge to its sort of being qualified is accepted or whatever. But popularly, I mean, it's still a very popular initiative among the public, right? I mean, most people in Utah have said that they are in favor of this sort of expanded medical marijuana.
Yeah. I mean, the problem has been is that the legislature's just chipping away at this, but they're going very, very slowly. And there are a lot of people who have gone years now saying that they're in need of this, the relief from the medical marijuana. And so the public, I think, this is my own personal opinion, I guess. I don't really have data to back this up, but I think what the public is frustrated with is they have people in their lives who suffer from these ailments that would be addressed by the initiative, and so they're fed up with, you know, being told by the legislature, well, we're going to, you know, go slow, we're going to, you know, follow the data. The data is there. The legislature doesn't want to see it. They don't want to admit that it's there, but they're just going very, very cautiously. And so I think the initiative has a lot of broad public support. Again, as Dan mentioned, the church is opposing this fairly aggressively. And we'll see, you know, political leaders, we'll see the Utah Medical Association coming weighing in against it, and we'll see how much they're able to erode that. I think Utah Policy had a poll the other day that said the church weighing in on it made about 40% of the people more likely to oppose it and 40% of the people more likely to support it, and 20% with no change. So, you know, maybe there's not, maybe it hasn't been a big shift in public support. I think we're going into the field next week on a poll that will probably give us a little bit of more information as well.
Additional data. We will stay tuned for that. Two of the other initiatives we haven't really talked that much about are the Medicaid expansion initiative, which qualified for the ballot, as you said, Dan. The ballot question there would essentially be, do you want Utah to accept full Medicaid expansion? Is that right, roughly?
Right.
Yeah.
But there also would be a tax increase attached to that. And so while the concept is popular, it's always tougher when you're asking people to agree to raise their own taxes. So so that's a little. And on the redistricting, while I think that has support, it's not overwhelming support like we see with the medical marijuana and Count My Vote. It's just enough support to sort of have a kind of majority, but there were like a quarter or a third of people out there who say they don't have an opinion on this because it's kind of complicated stuff.
It's pretty esoteric.
We're talking about drawing maps and, you know.
Well, the question though is essentially, you know, do you want to have an independent commission instead of the state legislature in charge of redistricting after a census?
Although it's really not that simple because the legislature still has the final say. Yeah. You'd have to have a constitutional amendment to take that away from the legislature, which you can't do because the legislature would have to initiate, and they're never going to do that.
Right.
So what this would do, the commission would recommend these new boundaries, and then the legislature would have to vote it up or down without amending it. So it's a good concept, but it's complicated.
And it depends upon, of course, who would end up on this commission as well, right, Robert?
Right. It's supposed to be bipartisan and nonpartisan, and the notion is that the commission will recommend boundaries that they think are fair, and then try to publicly shame the legislature into adopting them. And whether or not the legislature can be shamed is an open question.
I think they can be shamed, and what we saw that we talked about the limited medical marijuana bill they passed this year. The only reason that passed was because there was an initiative out there.
Yeah.
I mean, they wouldn't have. You talk about slow walking, they wouldn't have even done that had the initiative not existed.
Some leverage there. Yeah. Well, we've got some ballot initiatives that will appear on the November ballot. And speaking of things that will or will not appear on your November ballot, Dan Harry, Republican primary debates were held this week for a couple of key Utah races, a Senate race and a House race. And actually, you know what? That House debate between Representative John Curtis and Chris Herod, we saw in that debate a difference of opinion over a Trump nominee. Mm-hmm. And what I'm thinking we'll do here is actually just detour for a moment to get that background first from Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, and then circle back around for some debate analysis. But so, Tommy, I'm hoping that you are still there on the phone. Are you there?
Roger.
Okay, great.
I'm here.
Glad to
nice
hear it. Thanks very much. What I was just alluding to there is that there was this surprise appointment of a Utahn to head a federal office, and the appointee here is controversial, and I use that word rarely, but it's in this instance it kind of makes sense, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But we're talking about Ron Mortensen. Who is Ron Mortensen, and what is the role that the president has tapped him to fill, Tommy?
Sure, this is one of those surprising things. So the White House pretty much daily sends out these emails around 6 p.m. Eastern time with a list of, you know, like 5-10 people that they're nominating for different positions, and this is very common. And this one, it was interesting, though. I catch this email, and I look at it, and I'm like, I know that guy. And a quick Google search, I'm like, oh, that is that guy. It turns out Ronald Mortensen is being nominated to be essentially the State Department's person over refugees. The correct title is he's over the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration. Excuse me. And this is a pretty important job at the State Department. It's a very top position under Secretary Pompeo. Mortensen has been known to be a very anti-illegal immigrant advocate. He links immigrants to high crime rates. He believes that the Dreamers have committed identity theft. He's a fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies, which is considered a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And there's a lot of people who have come out against him, including just this week, Senator Jeff Flake, Arizona Republican, who's on the Foreign Relations Committee, and that's a big deal. This is a Republican nominee in a Republican administration with a Republican Senate, and we're already finding opposition within the Foreign Relations Committee.
And as you said, in addition to Jeff Flake coming out, you mentioned a number of groups who've come out with strong statements opposing his nomination. And you said Southern Poverty Law Center, ACLU. There were some others that I think you mentioned.
The Anti-Defamation League, the Ford.us. I mean, there's a bunch of groups. And Senator Menendez, the ranking Democrat on foreign relations, also came out very strongly concerned about pretty much what he said is a bigot for a job of this stature.
The Senate is going to have to vote on this nomination. What do Utah senators say about Mortensen's, the choice of Mortensen and about the statements that he's made about immigrants or writing that he's done? And maybe if you can somehow draw attention to what he has said so that we have a better sense of who he is.
Yeah, sure. No, of course. I mean, like, so he's written a lot. There's a lot of postings on the Center for Immigration Studies. He was, a columnist for The Hill newspaper here in Washington at one point. We've had op-eds and quoted him, many times. He links, he pretty much has said that immigrants commit crimes at a higher rate than our current population. They're either gangbangers or they steal identities or they're committing murders.
The data doesn't back that up, though. Just right. I mean, we can. Oh,
go ahead. To be fair, absolutely. To be fair, like no, there's no data that proves that whatsoever. And that's a critic of what all the critics have been saying about him is that he's just throwing these out there. And they're kind of gaslighting. There's no truth to what he's saying. It's no surprise in some ways. He was a big Trump supporter before. Trump loves loyalists and appoints them to positions and sometimes pardons them, as we're seeing. He's been out there. Not that we're always being fair, but he was a career diplomat in the Foreign Service. He has done humanitarian things with USAID. He has done a lot of work in other countries, but the concern here is this rhetoric that is seen as very anti-immigrant and which some have concerned said is racist.
And And you, I guess, sorry, maybe I missed this part, but Utah senators, have they weighed in?
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that part of the question. So we don't know yet whether Senator Orrin Hatch or Mike Lee will support Mortensen.
Okay.
When I asked Hatch's office about Mortensen, the response was essentially, this position is very important, and you know I've worked at this position for a long time. They didn't even address his nomination, to be honest.
Go ahead.
One thing Tom and I talked about a little bit about was that it seemed like, tell me if I'm wrong, Tommy, that the senators were caught by surprise with this. The nomination hadn't been vetted with them, and I don't think they like that very much when that happens from, you know, somebody from their state.
No, you're correct, Dan. It's just tradition here in Washington that if you're going to nominate somebody from your state, you talk to the senators because you're going to want their support for this nominee, right? In this case, they were both caught by surprise. They didn't know this. They were never consulted. And maybe we're seeing that with Hatch's response, which is tepid at best. And when it comes to Senator Lee, he's looking forward to, you know, hearing more, but, you know, has known Mortensen. We'll see. But, again, it's not the way to start out a process where this nominee is already controversial and you can't even get your home state senators on board.
Well, I also think with Hatch, he's been, you know, a major cheerleader of Trump here and likes to tout his relationship with the president. And for this to kind of blindside him like that, I suspect there's a little resentment there.
Hey, Tommy, just what does Mortensen himself say about the criticism that is, you know, showing up right now as a result of this nomination?
You know, this is one of those tough parts about being a reporter covering things like this, because when you're nominated to a Senate-confirmed position, you can't talk to the media. And so, like, I always want to get, you know, their side and their take, and Mortensen, in the couple emails we exchanged, has just referred me to the State Department. The State Department refers me to the White House. And so there's really nothing he can say, technically, because he's not allowed to speak to the media. So we don't know what he's going to say. But we will get this. There will be a confirmation process. So we'll get a hearing where he's going to have to sit before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's going to have to answer questions from Republicans and Democrats. And I assume a few sparks will fly.
Robert Gerke wrote about this nomination as well. What do you know about this guy?
Well, Ron's a nice guy. I mean, if you talk to Ron about as Tommy mentioned, he does a lot of overseas with USAID. He goes to Iraq. He's been in East Africa, and he's a pleasant enough guy. He's a little odd, I guess, but then you know. But his views on immigration are very. Outside the norm, I think they're way outside of the norm, and so I was shocked that this is the guy that the Trump administration decided to go ahead and pick for this job because it's an important job. He doesn't really have the experience running a big agency, and this has a $3.4 billion budget, you know, to try to bolster refugee programs across the globe. And so now you mentioned, you know, what are his supporters or what is he saying?
Right.
He's not saying much, but his supporters are out there. People like Chris Herod are saying, well, Ron is against illegal immigration, and they draw a clear distinction between legal immigration, which they are okay with, and illegal immigration, which they think needs to be stomped out. But you know, Ron is he's said that John McCain rolled out the welcome mat for ISIS, which I don't think is going to help him get Senator McCain's vote. And he's said that State Senator Luz Escamilla is an agent of the Mexican government. He's throws around these numbers about 80,000 Utah children having their identities stolen, even though there's really not any indication. I mean, he's sort of extrapolating data on that. So he's got some pretty fringe views on these issues, and I think he's really going to have a hard time if he gets a hearing. I think he's going to have a hard time getting confirmed because, again, you've got Jeff Flake against him. You've got the Utah senators who are tepid on him. I asked the governor what he thinks of Ron's nomination, and usually the home state governors are eager to see people in the Trump administration, and the governor said no comment. I can't imagine Bob Corker is going to be a big fan of this guy, who's the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and it's he's he's got a tough road ahead of him if he wants to be confirmed.
I know you need to move on, but quickly, this is fascinating. I reached out to a whole slew of Republicans on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee this week, and no one wanted to talk. It was fascinating. All the Republicans were like, we'll get back to you.
Okay. Yeah. A bit of no comment there as well. Thomas Burr, thank you for this. We're going to take another quick break here, and then when we come back, we will return to the debates that took place this week. That's just ahead on Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Robert Gerke, and Thomas Burr. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Dan Harry, as I mentioned before, this week saw a Senate primary debate and a House primary debate. And let's go back to that House race. This was a debate between Representative John Curtis and Chris Herod, two Republicans. But this wasn't two candidates splitting hairs over policy. This was two candidates with actual differences of opinion about a variety of things. One of those things being this Trump nominee that we mentioned earlier, Ron Mortensen. Mm-hmm. The other is the Republican Party standard bearer himself, Donald Trump. How did these two candidates differ in the debate? And tell us about the debate, Dan.
Yeah. So Chris Herod, you know, essentially said that he would support the president and criticized Curtis for not totally embracing him. Although, if you look at Curtis's votes, I really don't know that he is, you know, distanced himself from the president on policy matters. He's criticized some of his tweets and his, as he calls it, personality. But I don't think he's really differed with him substantially from policy. Now, we may see this on some of the immigration thing. It's kind of hard to pin down John Curtis on immigration, to tell you the truth. When he first ran last year in the special election, there were ads posted on his Facebook page, campaign page, about supporting the building the wall and sanctuary, criticizing sanctuary cities and so forth. And he pulled those down. There was some controversy. He blamed an advertising contractor for those. So we haven't seen it yet. I mean, he's still new. You know, he just took office last November.
Right.
So we don't really know that much about his policies on those kinds of issues. We know more about where he stands on local issues because he was the Provo mayor for 8 years. And they argued about such things as the BRT, the new transit system down there getting in Utah County.
You know, is it on you said that he wasn't necessarily differing from the president on policy issues, but is it unusual to have an incumbent? And I know that, as you said, he's an unusual incumbent. He hasn't been there that long. But still to have him not lining up behind the Republican president in a Republican primary election?
Well, that's a question not only in that race, but also maybe even bigger, looming bigger in the U.S. Senate race,
right,
where Mitt Romney, who obviously during the last presidential campaign was the biggest, most vocal Republican critic of the president. And he's since, you know, backed away from that. But there are times when he has again come out, you know, criticizing the president. Charlottesville was one of those examples. He is more recently criticized the naming of Jeffress, the pastor, to
open the embassy.
To open the embassy
in
Jerusalem, and calling him a bigot because of his comments about the Mormon Church and also Islam. And Herod, you know, excuse me, Mike Kennedy, his opponent, has ended up, you know, apologizing to Jeffress, which we're still all scratching our heads about. And that came up again in the debate. So on policy matters, there wasn't a lot of distance between the two in that debate.
In the Senate race here, yeah.
Right. But again, I think the looming question over that is, what is Mitt Romney, if elected, going to do in terms of his relation toward Trump? It's still an open question.
Hmm.
If I can jump in there, I think that's
Tommy Burr.
It's gonna be fascinating to see, and I think it's my full time job next year when if Romney's elected. You know, of course, we still have the general election against Jenny Wilson, but if Romney's elected. Is he going to be the kind of Jeff Flake who's always critical of this administration, or is he going to sometimes play ball? It will be so fascinating to see.
It will be interesting to see. And Dan, just going back to the actual debate between Kennedy and Romney on this, and I mean, it's what Tommy's sort of presuming there is that Romney's going to win this election hands down. But did Kennedy find a way to carve out? You know, some sort of name for himself in this debate?
Not really. I mean, he called Mitt Romney a carpetbagger. He welcomed him to the Beehive State. And, you know, those are kind of the chords that he's trying to reach with folks who have Republicans who have questions about Romney. But, you know, there was nothing new there. There was no new angle to come at. And again, on policy matters, they ended up agreeing on a lot of things. Health care, they ended up agreeing. So,
Robert Kirky, who does that help? I mean, if the fact that they're agreeing on so much, both Kennedy and Romney.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Mitt's up 40 points, so he just has to run out the clock at this point. So it's, you know, Kennedy, he needs to capitalize on his opportunities to do some damage, to make a dent in Romney's, you know, veneer. And it's just, he didn't do it.
He got distracted on that Jeffress thing and, you know, just burned up all his opportunity right there.
Well, and you end up talking about or trying to explain an unpopular position that you took and not going after your opponent. That's wasting time. But frankly, you know, Mitt Romney has been all over on so many issues that it's kind of hard to go after him on the issues because he's been all over the place, you know. And so you know, you can attack him for being, you know, pro-choice like he said he was when he was running for Senate in Massachusetts, but then he can say, well, no, I've been, you know, pro-life, you know, since when I was running for president. It's hard to pin him down. He's pretty squishy on the issues. So yeah, Kennedy, as we suspected when he came out of convention, surprisingly, has his work cut out for him. I think, and you know, barring some sort of miracle, is probably not going to beat Romney in that primary.
And we need to understand that, you know, ballots are going to be mailed out next week, so people are going to start voting here quite quickly.
How about just Robert Kirky, your analysis on the race in the third congressional district Republican primary? This is Curtis and Herod. They did differ pretty.
Yeah.
Substantially on the Trump question, for example,
yeah,
in
yeah.
their debate. Your analysis there, is it as easy a walk for the incumbent, well, for John Curtis in this instance?
I mean, it should be. Obviously, Curtis beat him in the special election. The one wild card, I guess, in that one is that there was a third candidate. So potentially, I guess, that those voters who voted for Tanner Ainge could, you know, play a role in the outcome of this. But I think, you know, Curtis is probably pretty safe right now, it would look like. And I would suspect that many of those voters who voted for Ainge are going to end up going to Curtis anyway. Herod doesn't seem to be campaigning as aggressively as he did last year at this time. I think he recognizes that, you know, it's an uphill battle to ever beat an incumbent. And especially one that's beaten you before and hasn't really done anything to alienate voters. I mean, the conventional wisdom is that if you're an incumbent and you haven't, you know, been involved in a huge scandal, you're going to win like 95% of the time. So I think, and I think Curtis is playing it pretty conservatively, campaigning conservatively. He is a, you know, maybe not a conservative as Herod would like him to be, but it seems like he's probably on a trajectory to win this race.
Okay. With that, you guys, we are out of time and need to head to our final segment of the show, which is the underplayed stories of the week. And you know what? I'm going to start with Dan Harry on this. Dan, what's your pick for underplayed?
Walter Plum.
Okay.
Who is Walter Plum? Walter Plum is an attorney and developer who was Orrin Hatch's former law partner, and he's the big money behind the anti-medical marijuana initiative. He's dumped, I think, $100,000 into that. And he has a long history of crusading against the perils of marijuana and the gateway drug to heroin and all kinds of other
things.
Didn't
he say
things.
In that flyer that it's a drug of black and Mexican
Yeah,
people?
And yes. He had a vocabulary, I guess, of Hispanics and blacks.
Yeah.
So. Wow. Okay.
He's a peach.
That's an amazing pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Robert Gerke, your
Go
pick.
Go check
there.
It out, yeah. My pick for Underplayed Story is Peyton Harkins did a piece this week on the RSL coach who was charged with assaulting domestic abuse and has been released, I believe, from the team. And so, you know, it's one of those things where the team moved quickly to address this. I think they probably did the right thing in addressing it. And if you're an RSL fan, it's more turmoil for the team.
Check it out at sltrib.com. Thomas Burr, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Yeah, I just have to go there. So the President of the United States tweeted out this week about the New York Times making up a source, saying that their source did not exist whatsoever, in being quoted about the North Korean talks. Well, it turns out the source was speaking on a phone call the White House had organized with reporters. This is literally like something the White House did to help reporters, and this official speaking, you know, on background. And the president doesn't even believe this person exists. So I hope that person does exist. I hope they're having a drink right now.
A very real source. Great, Thomas Burr, thanks for your pick. I'm going to just quickly throw out there a story by Aaron Alberti about University of Utah trying to cut back on light pollution. They've been upgrading lights, putting hoods on light fixtures, and they say this will help wildlife improve safety because apparently it's actually harder to see under very bright light. That's my pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Dan Harry, Thomas Burr, Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for being here today.
Great.
Thank you.
That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to KCPW's Jesse Ellis, Utah Public Radio's Tom Williams, Alyssa Roberts, and Spencer Holsey. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll see you next week.